Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In the United States, as many as 10 million girls and women and as many as 1 million boys and men struggle with eating disorders. And eating disorders have the highest death rate of any mental illness. Almost 1 out of 10 people who struggle with an eating disorder will die as a result of it. Coming up later to help us mark National Eating Disorders Awareness Week will be Dr. Laura Hill. She's CEO and Chief Clinical Officer, the Center for Balanced Living in Worthington. And also joining us will be a survivor of a trio of related eating disorders. Right now, we welcome Joan Jacobs-Brumberg. Joan is Professor Emerita in Social History at Cornell University, and she's the author of Fasting Girls, The History of Anorexia Nervosa, and The Body Project, An Intimate History of American Girls. Welcome to the show, Joan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
There is a very long history of people with eating disorders. How far back do we go?
Well, I'm not certain, but my research has certainly called attention to the existence of many fasting women in the 13th century, in the medieval period. But the disorder that we know as anorexia nervosa, which has to meet certain criteria, was born or originated in the 1870s, both in France and the United States, and in England. Interesting, at this, all about the same time, 1872, 1873.
Which coincides with kind of an Enlightenment period in science and psychology as well, right?
Well, it's certainly the beginnings of scientific medicine. And these doctors were involved, these Victorian physicians were involved in something called differential diagnosis. In other words, they wanted to know why the girl was wasting. That was the term that they used. Why was she fasting? Why was she wasting? They didn't ask the psychological question why, but they were trying to figure the disease out from making sure that it wasn't consumption and that it wasn't tuberculosis.
Now we
recognize. In other words, let me just complete that and say that she had anorexia, which means lack of appetite. You can have that in pregnancy or depression, but this was nervosa, meaning nervous in origin.
Now we recognize such a thing as National Eating Disorders Awareness Week, but when did eating disorders emerge in the public consciousness as a concern?
I don't think really until the 1970s. I think the death of Karen Carpenter was very significant in this understanding. I think you begin to get a generation of young people in high school and in college who know about the disorder. They come to the university sometimes to study psychology because they've had an experience with anorexia nervosa, either themselves or with a friend in high school. It really was not popular, if you will, until the late 20th century.
Is it something that the more we know about it and the more we hear about it, the more you hear about it and the more you know about it?
Is it
occurred at a sort of a stable rate? We just didn't know much about it over time.
Well, I think it's at a pretty stable rate now, but I think that the disorder does suffer from what we call diagnostic drift, what you were just referring to, the studies show that if you know somebody with bulimia or anorexia nervosa, you're more likely to develop it.
My guest is Joan Jacobs-Brumberg. She's a professor emerita at Cornell University and also author of The Body Project. If you have a question or comment for Joan, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Joan will be with us till the end of the first segment. Joan, when did we start to peel away the distinguishing characteristics of bulimia versus anorexia nervosa versus binging and purging and all of that?
Well, that's pretty modern. I'd say in the last 25 or 30 years, really. You could look at something like the diagnostic and statistical manual of eating disorder, of mental disorders, and you would see how the definitions get refined and specified over time. A new DSM-5 will come out next year, and now we have something that's simply called binge eating disorder, which tends to actually involve more men than women, which is interesting.
And I was going to ask you, as far as men go, when did they start? When you look back over the literature, over history, it's mostly girls, and then boys, then women, and then boys, and then men. When did the male, when did it become an influence or an issue for
In the late 20th century, we begin to see boys in the constituency that develops eating disorders, and I think that says a lot about the fact that the cultural context does matter a great deal. When there's a big push for slenderness and a taut, lean body, young boys can also get caught up in that kind of thinking. Eating disorders do, however, seem to be predominantly female, despite what I've just said, that there are young men who are involved. It's still predominantly female across the life course. In other words, from the very young to the relatively old, and that's a change in the past 20 or 25 years. That the range of people getting an eating disorder is wider than it used to be.
I was reading about how in Victorian England, there were girls, the fasting girls. Some were regarded as attention seekers, and were some of them, because some of them starved to death while they were being studied, and that was sort of horrible.
Yeah, I think that the 19th century is interesting because you have modern medicine and old ideas about religious salvation kind of arguing around the beds of young women who claim that they don't need to eat. Some of these cases were phony, and when they could control and really know what the young woman was ingesting, they would discover that, in fact, she was taking some food. But I think that the point is that it's in the 19th century that the disorder that used to be in the religious realm is medicalized and cast as something for modern medicine to take care of.
Genetics play a role now. When did that become part of the discussion?
Well, again, last 20, 25 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, the idea that anorexia nervosa is a multi-determined disorder, meaning it involves biology, psychology, and culture, which is the most sophisticated way of dealing with it. And it means that there are some young women with a predisposition to it, or families possibly. That's all relatively new research.
You know, when we talk about the cultural influences and the desire to have a lean, taut body and that kind of thing, when did that come about? Because if you don't have to go back too many years to see, you know, the Botticelli-like bodies and of the great, you know, the great painter and how that was desirable. So when did we start thinking that thin was better?
That thin was better?
Or desirable. You know, when you see the models and
Well, I think that the way to think about it is that the cultural imperative to be slim begins to build in the early 20th century. Usually people talk about it at the time of the First World War with the flapper, with the dresses above the knees, more flesh showing, more activity. Movies are important. Mirrors are important. Scales are a part of the story. In other words, you have to have a certain kind of lifestyle to be aware of this kind of beauty imperative, and also you have to have a certain amount, you have to have enough food to reject it. So you don't find anorexia nervosa among, you know, the poor. It's a pretty much a middle class phenomenon and has been from the beginning. But the imperative to be slim, it isn't something that just happened with Twiggy in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
It's been building across the 20th century and is, you know, incredibly intense even now.
There haven't been many successful or any really success to change that either in the last 20, 25 years.
Well, I think there have been some. I mean, there have been
efforts.
Efforts at different kind of advertising, efforts with larger sizing, more of an emphasis on nutrition and exercise as opposed to what you look like. It's what can your body do rather than what it looks like. But there's still a lot of evidence that American women persist in this attempt to keep their bodies slim. I mean, even in nursing homes, there you'll find women who are on diets.
Okay, well, I want to thank you, Dr. Joan Jacobs-Brumberg, Professor Emerita at Cornell University. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. We have to take a break. We'll be right back and continue our conversation about eating disorders and how the treatments have changed over time, very different than they once were. Stay with us. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. It's 55 degrees in downtown Columbus, with a chance of rain later this afternoon and a high near 70 degrees. Rain showers are likely tonight with maybe a thunderstorm and a low of 52.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Central Ohio Trauma System, working with community partners to make Central Ohio a safer place to live. Details about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the Central Ohio Trauma System are at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
Welcome back to All Sides. We're talking about eating disorders. Our understanding of them and the treatment of them have changed really drastically over the last 20, 25 years, maybe the last 30, 35 years. Joining us now is Dr. Laura Hill. Dr. Hill is the CEO and Chief Clinical Officer of the Center for Balanced Living. It's a nonprofit organization that specializes in the prevention, treatment, and research of eating disorders. It is based in Worthington. She's a clinical assistant professor as well with the Department of Psychiatry at Ohio State University. Welcome to the show, Laura.
It's nice to be here.
What are the most common eating disorders as we understand them in 2011?
The most common eating disorders are anorexia nervosa, where the individual starves oneself to a point that is grossly below what is healthy, resulting in the shutting down of many systems within the body. So there's extreme emaciation and fear, really, of food objection and avoidance to food. Then there's bulimia nervosa, and bulimia is one an illness where one will find oneself eating uncontrollably large amounts of food, which we call binge eating, and then finding countermeasures to try to get rid of that food, such as self-induced vomiting or laxative abuse or diuretic abuse. And then there, the new disorder on the block, so to speak, is binge eating disorder, which it looks like it's going to become a formal disorder next year when the new diagnostic manual comes out. And it is the illness where a person is uncontrollably binge eating but does not use counter methods such as purging to get rid of the food. So that person will typically move more and more into obesity. And it is different from just overeating in the level of uncontrollability, and often the person is highly depressed and anxious as well, maybe obsessive compulsive. Most of the illnesses and eating disorders share other psychological illnesses such as anxiety disorder and obsessive disorder. And while we make them discrete to define them, they run back and forth. A person may move start with anorexia, and about 50% of persons with anorexia evolve into bulimia diagnosis, and some may move into just binge eating, and then some may flow back down. The genetic vulnerability to one or the other can trigger one to move more in one direction or another. And some cases, it's the lifestyle may cause the body to be so stressed that it then starts reacting and responding, and then the vulnerability moves into the illness. So we look at them, and we're understanding them now more and more. In some ways, those illnesses are the way we've defined them, but we're starting to look at them differently, and that I think is so interesting. In 1980, when the first diagnosis even came out.
So it was only 1980.
1980. So just like Joan Brumberg said, they're old to history but relatively new to science. And in 1980, in the Diagnostic Manual, was the first diagnosis of bulimia nervosa, and then anorexia was added in. And it wasn't until 1994 that binge eating started to even come into the picture, and we started looking at it. And now 2011, we're moving into 2012, we'll have a formal diagnosis.
Is this because do these changes and these additions into the, you know, the annals of science history mm-hmm. occur because there is a change and there's something monumentally that's changed, or that finally, you know, it's all the peer reviews are done and everybody agrees and all the kind of the scientific mumbo jumbo you guys do to agree on everything has been, you know, has occurred?
You know, it's I think as science is becoming more adept at understanding the inside as well as the out, as we're looking at the brain more completely. In 2006, the National Institute of Mental Health declared eating disorders as a brain-based illness. And we've always looked at it up until then as an illness that is pretty much a social issue where a girl may start dieting, and we just looked at it from the outside in. And we knew that there was some level of interplay, that there was a biological aspect, but we often thought it was the biological aspect was what went awry once she was dieting too much. We're now realizing when that genetic precursor sets the stage, so to speak, and the girl begins to diet from whatever pressures, or the male begins to diet, or the 45-year-old begins to diet and begins to put the body under pressure. And if there is that vulnerability, certain aspects begin to change. And we're actually, thanks to the research of, for example, Dr. Walter Kay at University of California at San Diego, in his study of the circuitry of the brain, we're seeing actual circuit paths that are unique, for example, to anorexia, that are malfunctioning. And we're beginning to realize that persons looking at it from this inside-out perspective, people with eating disorders have a different reaction to food while they're experiencing this illness.
It could be that somebody's who's addicted to risk, a gambler, they're mm-hmm. finding the same sorts of paths in gamblers, right?
Yes. And in fact, the binge eating disorder is following a similar path to an addiction path of drugs and other. There, it's a dopamine path that comes right up. And there's, with binge eating, for example, we're finding, if you're thinking of a circuit, thinking of it like maybe a train track going from Chicago to New York City, and there's a circle back to Columbus, we're finding that some of the stations along that circuit are overfiring, for example, with binge eating. So, for example, the insula has extreme taste, and the sense of taste is just magnifying and wonderful. But then when the body goes to register that wonderful taste in the nucleus accumbens, there's very little firing. So it's like, I'm not satisfied. So you get this wonderful taste, but no satisfaction, and we're finding another circuit actually under fires hunger, so you have no sense of fullness and hunger. So you can't eat mindfully when you have binge eating because you don't have the ability to register what full hunger is until it's so extreme and the body is in such pain that the person has to stop eating. So they have this wave, like if you're going on an alcohol binge, you go into this surge of this food is wonderful and you chase the pleasure, but you get no satisfaction and no fullness.
My guest is Dr. Laura Hill. Dr. Hill is a CEO and Chief Clinical Officer of the Center for Balanced Living. It's a nonprofit organization that specializes in the prevention, treatment, and research of eating disorders. It's in Worthington. So the genetic, what's going on genetically, it's not genetically necessarily psychologically genetically. It's actually a physical reaction of your body to food or the lack of food. Or to exercise, or the lack of exercise, or gambling, and all of that.
It appears through Cindy Bulick's research out of Chapel Hill that and others that the genes, like one way she's explained it is, the genes take the bullets, load the cartridge, and then the environment or the situation can help shoot the gun. And so we've got somebody that may be multi-gene. It's not one gene. There are multiple genes, and we relatively know, I think there are 26,000 different kinds of genes, and we know maybe one section, one gene area of it, of that huge picture. And what we're discovering is that the person who is vulnerable like that may react very differently to food. I think it's very interesting, for example, we have that vulnerability and then the chemicals begin to go awry in the brain for a person with anorexia or bulimia. For example, when you eat proteins every morning, you get up and you eat eggs, you're getting a lot of protein. Those proteins break down in your system and they move into tryptophan, and then the tryptophan, some of it crosses through the blood-brain barrier and goes into the blood and makes serotonin. Many people have heard of serotonin. It's a chemical that the brain makes. When it's at healthy levels, you feel good. When it's at really low levels, you're usually depressed. High levels, we often get a lot of anxiety, and it's very involved in eating disorders and anxiety and depression. But the interesting thing is what appears unique with anorexia is the person who, when they're eating those proteins and it makes the serotonin in that circuit that's now been identified, there's a part that absolutely goes off the chart when the serotonin starts up. And it creates levels of delusions that are even greater than schizophrenia in the 5-HT level in the brain. So the instinctive response would be, stop eating that. I'm not going to eat that. It makes me think crazy. So the anorectic is going to start eliminating foods, often proteins first, because it's the very agent that aids in the chemical that makes her start experiencing major mental reactions. So she is going to back off.
She's not doing this consciously necessarily,
totally,
though.
Totally not conscious.
Just like,
it's just a normal reaction. That makes me uncomfortable. I'm not going to do that. And the more you move into that direction, the brain begins to move into a malnourished level. So then reasoning logic gets narrower and narrower as other circuits begin to shrink from the starvation. And bulimia, also very different circuits, but also related circuits. And so in one way, I've begun to think of this, Anne, as just like a person who may have type 2 diabetes, and they go, well, I can't eat certain sugars now unless, and I've got to give myself some insulin. We're now beginning to shift and realize when a person has an eating disorder, it's very much they have a reaction. They cannot sit and respond to food as easily as somebody, as no more than a person who has diabetes, and you have to make sure the sugars are adjusted to the insulin you take. So we now even look at food more as medicine and dose it to a level that the person can tolerate so we can make sure they have balance, and then they get used to the food so that they can deal with the pain. And then in some cases, that person may be able to outgrow, brain will rewire and move on and flow on, and they can then move on into a point where it no longer dominates anymore.
I was going to ask you, because there's been a lot of concurrent research on brain elasticity now, really in the last 5 or 6 years. And I was wondering, is that an exciting turn of events for people? So you can change the wiring, you can change those circuits and those railroad tracks.
Yes. It's the miracle of the brain. It's the wonder of what the brain can do to heal itself. And that doesn't mean for somebody who is maybe strongly genetic, the vulnerability may continue. And then when under major stress experiences, it may go back and start malfunctioning again. And then if the person regroups and go, oh my gosh, I've got to start, really containing my food so that I can get back and get into a ritual again so that I can manage this better, then the person may be able to stabilize again. For some people, many people, the illness may remain chronic. For others, especially if we catch it early, the brain has that ability to outwire, rewire, and protect. But for women compared to men, you were mentioning that earlier. Kelly Klump out of Michigan State University has done some really new research in the last year or two, wondering, always asking, why is it more among women than men? And what she is finding in preliminary research is it appears that the testosterone in the male actually aids as a shield to prevent some of those genes and some of the abnormalities to turn on.
So if the testosterone levels vary in men, then the occurrence of the eating disorders will vary likewise. And with the complete absence of it in most women, all things being equal, you have a greater occurrence of it. At what point is the have they found that these chemical reactions and these genetic predispositions are triggered by puberty at all? Because the girls, they really don't tend to get into it until 13, 14 years old. I'm sure there are exceptions.
Eating disorders range from early, childhood through elderly.
Okay.
And actually, the average age of people treated at the center is 33 to 38.
For treatment, onset.
But onset, clearly, the interesting thing is it appears that when puberty begins to shift in the body, one way we've begun to look at it is the genes literally have some on-off shifts and switches. And so at puberty, the hormones indicate and literally certain genes turn on, increasing the vulnerability. So we know that puberty is a high onset for anorexia and bulimia. Around 18, when a whole new swell of stresses occur, we're seeing a new onset stressing those genes or that vulnerability, and binge eating and some more bulimia begins to occur. And then interestingly, we see new onsets occur after pregnancy or again, the hormone shifts. So there are hormone changes have a real impact on how it turns on, off the shift, the switches for the genes.
So how has all of this, when just listening to all this, it reminds me of when I, went to Smoke Stoppers and learned to stop smoking. And a big component of that was educating me about the physiology of nicotine. Does educating your clients and the people that go to Center for Balanced Living, educating them about the physiology of this, does that help?
We're finding it helps greatly, Anne, because just like if you have a 13-year-old who develops diabetes, then family needs to be informed, okay, this is the fact. Her pancreas isn't working well. We've got to figure out what the formula is and what's the recommended dose of the insulin and how do I learn to give shots to be able to help. Diabetes actually makes eating disorders look simple and nice. I mean, eating disorders are so complex. Diabetes is the simple side of it because it's so medical. The psychology of it is, in our social approach to eating disorders is, why don't you just eat? Why don't you just let yourself? Food is so normal. Why can't you just relax and eat? And you can't. So the family being educated and understanding the biology, the psychology, and the reaction to food suddenly can stop making it an issue and just go, well, this is what needs to be done.
Well, if it's actually making you feel worse,
yes,
then it's like as if you're saying, well, why don't you just keep taking that pill that's making you hallucinate?
Exactly.
614-292-8513 if you want to join the conversation. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about the science of eating disorders right now. It's not as psychological as you might think. So give us a call if you have any questions or comments. My guest is Dr. Laura Hill. She's CEO and Chief Clinical Officer at the Center for Balanced Living. It's a nonprofit organization that specializes in the prevention, treatment, and research of eating disorders, and it's in Worthington. So In your online literature, I was looking at that, you say that the search for causes for something to blame is understandable, mm-hmm. but not very helpful. Mm-hmm. So that's what this is all about, mm-hmm. because if you don't start out with the initial chemical reaction that's causing it typically. Now, are there still some people out there who it's purely psychological, that they don't? Can you test for the genetics of it, for one thing, and rule that out or rule it in?
Well, if anything, the genetic research, NIMH is doing a great job in conducting some extensive multi-site genetic findings, seeing how highly vulnerable the genetic is and how highly heritable the illness is. And at the same time, where you go in testing, I mean, there are all kinds of places springing up to help you, provide that profile. The issue and where we're looking at it now, though, is where that develops, who's to know. But we really want patients and people who might be vulnerable to it to begin to honor the fact that just like you might be vulnerable to diabetes, how do I start eating healthy to not allow my body to move to the point that I may be so overweight that I'm going to be developing type 2 diabetes? So what can I be doing with my family to help that child who may be pretty rigid in her style? She only eats certain kinds of food. Then let's just make sure that she's going to get a good healthy balance, but she may be choosing one or two kinds of meals and eating them pretty regularly. But if the nutritionist is saying she's getting all she needs, then mom and dad, just stop, just back off, let her have those one, two types of meals and let her grow strong with that, and she'll be less anxious and be able to live stronger. If what we're finding is when the eating disorder starts developing and all these varieties of foods are placed on them, you've got to have this, you move into this challenge, you're actually creating more anxious, more more disturbance in the brain for the anorexic. Now, the bulimic, it's a matter of needing to structure the food, because again, there's less signal when the illness is strong of any sense of fullness or hunger. So it's pre-planning what I'm going to eat, because if I don't pre-plan it, I don't know when to stop. It's going to be go until I can't eat anymore. And so the bulimic usually needs to pre-plan, but they can usually tolerate the variety quite well. And the binge eater, it's very much about pre-planning and dosing the food, and often containing the obsessive compulsive is not uncommon with binge eating, and attention deficit is not uncommon with binge eating. So the more the person is receiving a support for those illnesses will also help curb the eating patterns of the illness. We have a family program that we've been testing, and we're now getting ready to finish our manual. And we've been testing it for 2 years now, and it's called Fed Up, Get Fed, and it's a family education program for eating disorders. And we've been looking at the biology, the psychology, and actually testing what works and what doesn't work in help families supporting their loved ones, husbands supporting wives, mothers and dads supporting their daughters, what works and what doesn't. And the program is an 8-hour and every other month at the center, and it's usually filled to the brim, and people come from all over to be able to just get updated information.
We'll post that website on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We have to take another break. We'll get to your calls, and we'll also meet Julia Weissenborn. She is recovered from an eating disorder, and tell us about her perspective. If you have questions or comments, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Last week on Car Talk, once again, we were brilliant.
Absolutely brilliant.
Is it more likely to happen when you have the defroster on?
No. Because... No.
I'm going to ask you one more time, Lorraine. Is it more likely to happen when you have the defroster on?
You know the penalties for perjury.
Don't miss the fun this week.
Join us for Car Talk.
And Car Talk starts tomorrow at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Be sure to watch Columbus on the Record tonight at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. This week, Mike Thompson and his panel discuss the pros and cons of using tax hikes to balance budgets. Also, Governor Kasich calls on casinos to pay more. Those discussions and more on Columbus on the Record. It's tonight at 8:30 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Foundation, celebrating our nationally ranked businesses and nonprofit leaders, making our community stronger. With donors and funds in 33 Ohio counties, the Columbus Foundation, where your philanthropy and your community come together.
Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. All Sides Weekend begins with a discussion of the movies in theaters right now and a preview of the summer movie season. All Sides Weekend begins at 11. It's currently 58 degrees in downtown Columbus. A slight chance of rain today, mainly after 5 p.m., and a high of 69. All Sides continues.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I didn't even get to half my questions with Dr. Laura Hill from the Center for Balanced Living. Luckily, she's still with us, and thanks for staying with us, Laura. Joining us now is Julia Weissenborn. Julia developed an eating disorder when she was 16 years old. She was treated when she was 21 for symptoms of anorexia, bulimia, and binging. And Julia also grew up with an anorexic mother who still battles her eating disorder. At age 24, Julia has been in recovery for about 2 years. She has a job, and she now participates in activities sponsored by the Center for Balanced Living to help the family and friends of someone who has an eating disorder. And Julia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Julia, did you know you had a problem, or did someone else have to tell you?
Actually, someone else had to tell me. Growing up with a mother who had anorexia, I didn't even know that what an eating disorder was until I had already graduated from high school and I was in college and the word was being thrown around. So for me developing it, I thought it was more of just losing weight and some kind of psychological battle I was facing. I didn't realize there was an actual name and disease behind what I was going through. So it wasn't until I would say I was about 18 where I understood what an eating disorder was and that I had one and that my mother had one as well.
Is this something that you've worked with your mother on, or is it a very independent journey?
It's a very independent journey. It's something, while I had the eating disorder, we are very close and discuss stuff relating to eating disorders in terms of exercise and food. And, you know, she always encouraged me to get treatment as well. But in terms of part of my treatment process or recovery process, that's a very independent thing. And it was actually very difficult for me to talk to her about it or be with around her when I was going through that, just because it was very triggering and very hard for me to sit down and eat certain meals and cut back on exercise when she wasn't doing the same. So it's something that you really have to go through on your own and find people outside of your triggering or your old habits that can support you and help you through those difficult times.
How did it start for you? Do you remember the first time you felt like I ate too much or I need to exercise more today because I had too much food at lunch?
Mine really ties back to, I think, running. I was a competitive runner in high school, and then I also went on to run competitively at the collegiate level as well. And I'm just a competitive person by nature, so when I wanted to do better, I noticed, like, as I started dropping weight and picking up my mileage, my times got faster. So I got addicted to the speed, more or less, and I wanted to keep getting faster, qualify for the state championship so I could go on and run at the college level. So I just kept losing weight until it got to the point of being unhealthy and malnourished. And that was between my junior and senior year of high school. Before that, it was more of just, I never cared what I put in my mouth or what I ate. It was just, or how much I exercised. It was just whatever was set down at the table in front of me. I ate it till I was full and I exercised as my coach said. So it was a really drastic change in my lifestyle.
Did your coaches notice it?
Yes, both my coaches and my, you know, family members and friends, they all noticed it. No, nothing was said to me, though, until the end of the cross-country season. And that's afterwards they came by and said, you know, it's great that you did this well, but you can't run anymore until you put on some weight. And I did have to put on some weight. And that, again, that was all just at home doing it on my own thing. And I gained enough weight to make people happy. Still, you know, underweight, but it was enough to make everyone feel a little bit better about things. Then I continued to keep running.
When was that point in your life when you knew you needed to get help that you had to save your life?
Mine was actually my junior year of college. And during my junior year, I had reached my lowest weight that I'd been at. And then I also switched over to doing from being strictly anorexic to going to bulimia and binge eating as well. So it was really the bulimia, the binge purge cycle, that really put me over the edge. It was the moment that I realized I needed help. It was after a particularly bad binge, and I was about to go out for a run. And I, like, as luck would have it, I tripped and fell during my run. And I just remember sitting there on the road crying and saying, I can't do this anymore. This is out of my control. So it's one of those situations where you keep telling yourself, tomorrow's when I'm going to get better. Tomorrow's when I'm going to stop binging. I'm going to stop purging. I'm going to stop restricting, and I'm going to get better. But that tomorrow never came. And it wasn't until I reached what I considered rock bottom when I was like, okay, I need to look up some websites, figure out who can take me, and just do this.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest, Julia Weissenborn, we're talking with her right now. She's 24 years old. She's been 2 years in recovery from an eating disorder, and we appreciate you coming on the show and talking to us about it. Also with us, Dr. Laura Hill. She's founder and CEO at the Center for Balanced Living in Worthington. If you have a question for them, either of them, give us a call. 614-292-8513. And Tom from Upper Arlington, you're on the show. Welcome.
Hi, thanks. I just wanted to say that I think a lot of these disorders, as well as the unhealthiness of the general American, is due to our culture's overemphasis on the taste of food. And every kind of processed food you can find in the grocery stores, there's thousands of them, they all emphasize taste. Mm-hmm. Everything we see on TV or the internet as far as food, it always says it tastes good. Mm-hmm. And, you know, taste is great, but it's not the purpose of eating food.
It's overrated.
What you want to eat is stuff that's healthy for you. And if it tastes good because you're able to cook it on a decent recipe or something like that, fine. But processed foods should be banned in America. I'll take your comments off the air.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for the call. Well, that goes to that issue.
If
everything's on taste, and you know, mm-hmm. you've got the taste things, the enhancers mm-hmm. that they put in foods now, and the sodium, mm-hmm. often that's over triggering some people.
And that goes back to what we were discussing earlier, in that the person who is vulnerable to binge eating, we know their insula is hypersensitive to even over above than what normal tasting is. So when you have fast foods that are trying to find this perfect balance of salt, sugar, and fats to create a taste sensation in every bite, let alone every form of food, that it does add to that heightened sense. So the binge eater is going to even be more heightened to try to follow that path, which only increases the fat mass and the obesity level. The normal person is responding to the taste, but not the anorexic, because the same station that is over-firing for the binge eater is under-firing. Typically, a person, when they're in the illness of anorexia, under-fires taste. Food is actually tastes like cardboard, or it's flatter. There is very little pleasure in the taste of eating, and therefore it's very easy not to eat.
Did the taste, how did the taste and the act of eating work for you, Julia?
You know, I will agree exactly with what Dr. Hill just said. When I was anorexic, food had no pleasure, taste, anything to me. It was just something I had to eat and get it over with. I mean, I would eat the most random things, too, that, you know, come up. I think that's found a lot, too. Anorexics will have weird food concoctions and such that they develop, and
That they are convinced this is what I need to stay alive, kind of a thing.
And like, I mean, so many times.
And skinny or whatever your goal is.
Yes. Right. And my friends would look at it and be like, what are you eating? And I'd be like, I would just say, hey, it tastes good. And, it, you know, looking back on it, it's like, how did I eat that? That is so disgusting. But it was one of those things that you really, food didn't have much of a taste. And if it did, didn't really matter anyway. Mm-hmm. But then when I switched over to the binging and bulimia part of it, everything was like exemplified. It was just like everything had explosive taste. And I just wanted more and more and more until the point where you got to where you were uncomfortable and literally could not. So it was very... two different, completely different experiences.
We have an email from Paula. She says, is it perceived that any disorder is more acceptable? I oftentimes hide in embarrassment over my past methods, laxative abuse, because I rarely hear it being addressed or people coming forward.
Laxative abuse is a common part of an eating disorder, both in anorexia and bulimia, and they are dangerous. The interesting thing about laxative abuse, when you're taking more laxatives than what is prescribed, and you're not taking them for constipation, you're taking them to try to address body image and weight issues. The facts are you could take 5 laxatives, you could take 10, you could take 50 laxatives, and it still does not get rid of any more than about 12 to 15% of your food bulk. Laxatives don't turn on until the end of the canal. And so what you are doing, the more laxatives you take, is you're depleting your body of its water. So you are dehydrating the body in acute levels, and with it go the electrolytes, and with that go the ability to stay alive. So you can badly dehydrate the more laxatives you take, and it becomes very addictive. So yes, it is an active part of the illness, and it is, interestingly, there have been one or two studies that show that laxative abuse, pure laxative abuse as the form of purging, is often high among African Americans, whereas the Caucasian may use both self-induced vomiting and laxatives, but the African American may turn to laxative as alone as the form of purging. But no matter which way one turns, the more the purge, the more the potential for the loss in hydration, and the loss in hydration takes the electrolyte, which takes the ability for the lights to go out, in essence.
And that can be a very precipitous drop.
Yes.
In your health.
Yes.
Very quickly.
Very quickly. Within, you need to get to the emergency room right away. And if the emergency room is not thinking about what caused you to take all of these, they wouldn't be screening for the eating disorder. They may just replace the potassium and send the person home, only for the next night that number of laxatives to occur again. The other thing I'll say, Anne, about laxative is when you start abusing them and increase them in number, it becomes so difficult to go off, because as you are draining the body of water, it will then do everything to rebound, to retain water, to keep you alive. So you, if a person stopped laxative abuse, which is what needs to happen as soon as possible, then the body will rebound with 5 up to 10, and we have found even up to 15 pounds of water within 10 days, which is a horrible experience, and why you should be in treatment to help manage that, because it's just, it's so awful to
experience. Like an addiction, you don't just go off anything like that cold
No,
turkey.
You need backup help to deal with the misery of the ramifications.
There's 3 good questions waiting on the phone, and I'm going to really try to get to them all. But Georgia, you've been waiting the longest, so have
Thanks.
At it. You're on the show. Welcome.
I'll try to be quick. I wondered if anybody knows if there's any correlation between the later development of these various eating disorders and some of the extreme food behaviors you see in young kids. I don't mean, you know, the kid that occasionally refuses their asparagus. I'm talking about the kind of child that fixates on, like, only eating mashed potatoes or only eating hot dogs or, you know, something that seems to go beyond the normal food pickiness of kids.
Thanks, Georgia. Now, is that what you were talking about earlier, Laura?
In some cases, I think the question is being raised, and as we're looking at the precursors of, for example, anorexia and the rigidity that develops, some of the researchers are trying to see and track, could this be precursor, or is this an obsessive compulsive or an anxious response? Dr. Kim Davis, Kim Brown at Nationwide Children's Hospital is doing some good work in with children to look at the foods that they just cannot take down or easily choking, because if they eat a food, they feel the perception of the choking. So there's good work in looking at it, but we haven't got the answers yet.
Mark from Gahanna, you're on the air, and I'm sorry, you only have about 30 seconds.
I was going to ask Dr. Hill just a question or just any comments she might have about the Maudsley approach. I know there's not a lot of time to answer, but I thought I'd throw that out.
Thank you, Mark.
You bet, Mark. James Locke and Daniel LaGrange have led the way in the States to fulfill the Maudsley approach that developed in England. And bottom line, it's helping to bring the family to a place. It seems to have valid form of treatment while the child is still under 18 and still in the home, and that it, when the family works with a clinician that can help coach them, they in turn help become some of those structural external points to help regulate where the internal part is not regulating as that brain is getting developed. And the beauty is during adolescence, lots of dendrites are growing and the brain can rewire. So the more the family is working to help set the external structure and supportive structure in the eating, then the child can potentially wire forward, get used to that eating and be able to tolerate it and move on and have a better prognosis. So I recommend their books.
Julia Weisenborn, are there any books that you would recommend, or is there anything that you would recommend to people out there that are questioning and maybe about your age and wondering, want to learn more?
The biggest help for me, and I actually got it on my first day of treatment, was the book called Life Without Ed. It's a book my whole family has read it, and a lot of people that I have been friends with or so have read as well. It's a woman's battle with an eating disorder and her recovery treatment, and it kind of gives an inside view of what someone with an eating disorder goes through. And if you were someone who's struggling with the eating disorder, it doesn't make you feel so alone in the process. You read the book and you're going, okay, I'm not the only one that has these thoughts or these behaviors or, you know, is going through these things. And then if you're someone on the outside looking in, trying to understand what someone with the eating disorder is going mm-hmm. through, it gives them an inside view of, okay, so eating really is this stressful for her, or she really is thinking these kind of things.
Julia Weisenborn, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And also Dr. Laura Hill from the Center for Balanced Living. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Ann.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org at 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Now, the next Fresh Air, we play back our interview with director Sidney Lumet. He died last week. His films include Dog Day Afternoon, Serpico, and Network. His first was the courtroom drama 12 Angry Men.
I found out after I had done the movie and people liked it that it was very difficult to shoot a movie in one room. That never occurred to me.
Join us
today at noon on 89.7 NPR News.